white shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Moral, the string.
Tension by our whole dress.
Moral, the string.
Great gowns.
Moral,
beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Moral,
no, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to the Every Outfit Podcast. Chelsea, how are you doing?
Oh, bitch, come on. You know I've had a rough week.
I was going to say, this week has really weaked. Like, some weeks, not that big of a week. This week, it's been a lot.
Too much week.
I need this week to end, frankly.
I do too, but it doesn't mean there haven't been fun things happening this week. Sugar Baby premiered in Glendale. I went to Glendale for maybe the third time in my life. I always forget about Glendale.
Be honest. That theater was pretty major that we had the screening at.
The chicken tenders were fabulous, I have to say.
Truly, right after we recorded last week's episode, Chelsea left and I got into hair and makeup and I was on my way to the premiere of my film, Sugar Baby, formerly known as Good Girl. I feel like I do need to say that because, you know, I posted on our Instagram about the release of the film on Tuesday, and there was just one comment from a fuckette that was like, ugh, I could only get 30% of the way through that book. It's atrocious. And I had to be like, oh, no. Because I went on Amazon, I was like, oh, there is a book of the same name. I was like, oh, no, this is an original script that my friend Brie Esring and I wrote. It has nothing to do with that book. And then the person commented, like, good to know.
That is good to know.
I have to thank you, Chelsea. You are an incredible Q&A host. You hosted the Q&A after the film.
I don't know about incredible, but I did what I needed to do.
Most importantly, you asked me, first and foremost, why I'm such a little pervert.
And I didn't really get a straight answer out of you.
I was going to say we didn't get to the bottom of it. But it was very nice to see the film with a crowd. I hate to say that I needed that, but I did need that external validation after months and months of being in tiny, dark post-production rooms to see it with a crowd who laughed at the right places and not at the film, most importantly, and gasped at a certain reveal towards the end of the film, which is not in the trailer. It's another thing I would like to comment on is, yes, someone was also like, this trailer does the thing that you guys hate, which is it reveals everything of the film. One, it doesn't. You've seen the film. There are twists and turns that are not in this trailer. But two, I don't know what to tell you. Our distributor was like, if we do not tell them what is in this movie, maybe people won't watch.
Right. You can't be too cryptic. But I'm truly so proud in that Kris Jenner hashtag proud mama kind of way.
Thank you very much. I'm sure you're also happy that finally this film won't be taking up any space in my head, because truly since January 2023, there has not been a week that there hasn't been a level 10 crisis involving this movie. So
I'm happy that's in the past for you, for sure.
Now I can fully focus on And Just Like That season 3.
As God intended.
I don't know if you came across this, but when I was getting to Glendale, I passed by Warner Brothers Studios, which was having a private event. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. They're having a film premiere on the studio lot. No, no. It was a Tesla event to unveil their new fleet of vans and robo-taxis.
Aren't they called cyber cabs?
I think so. The fact that the letter X is not anywhere in these new deliveries, I think, is impressive. But the thing that I want to talk to you about is the debut of the robots, the Optimus robots, who were the bartenders and did various dances for people, because you and I were texting each other about it. And I was like, what idiot would buy one of these when they come out in a couple years? And you were like, I would.
I didn't say I would. I would absolutely not buy one of these robots. People that don't want to pay housekeepers are who are going to buy these robots, which is why it's so fucked up. And it's why the cyber cab is fucked up, too, because it's like, I feel like this is just going to, like, annihilate working class jobs. Like, you can't even be a cashier at McDonald's anymore because they've replaced those jobs with screens.
And let me tell you, on our East Coast tour, we experienced those McDonald's screens at the airport. Took five times as long.
Yeah, not efficient. Although, the only benefit, and I'm not saying it's worth it, it is absolutely not, but it has never been easier to customize something at McDonald's.
Okay, back to these cyber robots. Because the idea is that they're going to sell for $20,000 or $30,000. And yes, he's clearly trying to replace domestic workers, but the video that they show about what this robot can do in your life, all that I saw was like, it can pick up a package incredibly slowly and it can water your plants. I didn't see any actual domestic labor like vacuuming, doing your laundry, folding said laundry.
Yeah.
So I have my doubts. And my doubts, I feel like, were further vindicated when we learned that these robots were not autonomous and were most likely being puppeted by human beings at the Tesla office.
They have a ways to go, clearly. I don't know. We've all seen Megan, right?
Yes.
Like, we know where this can go. And I just feel like there is a world where, you know, another country just sort of like takes control of all of the robots and then they just murder everyone instead of like launching a missile or something.
Well, there is that. As it stands now, they seem to be very expensive claw machines that don't work particularly well. I don't know if you saw the video of someone pointing, a guest pointing to a little packet that they wanted the robot to pick up and it couldn't. Like, it took a couple of tries and it also took 5 times as long.
I do think the idea of them making drinks is appealing, but it's like, can they actually make a tequila soda?
And what if they spill that tequila soda on themselves? Does it just combust?
Are they better or worse bartenders than the people that work at the AMC at the Grove? If any labor force needs to be replaced with robots, it's those bartenders.
Okay, that is a good use for them. I also thought about another good use for these Tesla robots. Because we know that they're going to be used for sex. Let's be honest here.
Oh, so you want to fuck the robots?
I don't want to fuck the robot, but because they are glorified claw machines, I feel like all they're possibly good for is like holding your Hitachi so you can like masturbate hands free.
Yeah, the Hitachi is just like so heavy, you know, your wrist just gives out at a certain point. But then you have to tell the robot like a little to the left, turn it up. I think we need to go to 3 now. Not 4. 4 is too much.
And let's be honest, it's probably someone else at a Tesla office powering that and then like is the one doing the dirty talk.
Yeah, those are the jobs that are going to be left.
So dark.
I wouldn't trust the cyber cab either because Tat's car now has the self-driving function and you're not supposed to like use the self-driving function and just like completely ignore the car. Like you're supposed to keep tabs on shit.
Not just keep tabs on it. You have to have your hands on the wheel. In my mind, sort of defeats the point, although thankfully Paul found a Reddit forum that gets around that. If you just put 2 water bottles in the wheel spokes, it simulates the pressure of hands on it. You can trick it.
No, but it can tell when you're holding a phone. Like, I think it actually is like recording you or something. Like, it's very scary. But the thing is that like humans, sometimes it doesn't know whether or not to accelerate through a yellow light or not. Like the other day, we were using the self-driving function and it just kind of stopped in the middle of the intersection. The light turned red and then it accelerated. And it's like, that's on me.
You've also said coming up to where I live, there's sort of a double entrance. Like you can make a right at 2 points that are very close together. And it's gotten tricked by that a few times.
Yeah, it gets confused by like highly specific intersections. So no, I would not trust a driverless car. Not at all.
Well, because those don't even have a wheel. So if shit goes wrong, you have no recourse to stop it.
This is like the definition of a first world problem. But it's insane to see how people react to Tat's Cybertruck. Like the other day we were leaving the Sweat Tour, the Charlie XCX, Troy Sivan co-headlining tour. And we're walking up to the car and this group of like sort of young Gen Z, vaguely alternative, possibly queer girls is like, ew, a Cybertruck. One of them's like, I'm going to go spit on it, and walks up to the car. And Tat's like, you're not going to spit on my car, bitch. And they were like, oh, shit, I don't think that they thought that the owners were standing right there, because maybe it wasn't like the finance bro that they expected, I guess.
Right. You weren't some Erewhon influencer and her finance bro walking up to the car.
Yeah. And then Isabel was like, come on, guys, we're all Charlie fans here.
Oh, no. How'd that go over?
Well, Tat was like, fuck off, get the fuck out of here. And I think they were scared, you know? They scattered.
Understandably so. At that point, they didn't know if Tat could turn on the car and have it go after them.
And if it did, I like to think the car would just play the Charlie song from the Barbie movie.
So how was the concert?
It was amazing. I'd never seen Troy before. I'd seen Charlie, and it was a great show. It really covered all the bases, because Troy did the sort of more typical like pop star choreo with the backup dancers and everything. Whereas Charlie, she just kind of sauntered around the stage and like felt more like a rock star. But she did do some ass shaking for sure. She had some moves.
Well, I heard, and by I heard, I saw it on TikTok, that people were saying the night one crowd kind of dead.
Okay, I have no point of reference for how the crowds have been, but everyone was standing up. Everyone was dancing.
What I saw were videos of Charlie kind of beckoning the crowd to sing. So I think people have alleged that the crowd was a little dead.
Everyone in my section was singing.
There you go.
From my perspective, it was very rowdy, but maybe not as rowdy as the crowds that she's used to. But also, it was a Tuesday night.
We ourselves have faced what a Tuesday night crowd is compared to a Thursday, Friday, Saturday night crowd.
Yeah, you can't expect a Saturday night crowd on a Tuesday, even for the Sweat Tour.
Well, you, I think, went on the better night, because I've heard people complain. And again, I've heard means I saw it on TikTok that there were no guests for night two.
Yeah, we got Kesha, which was really fun. She came out and sang Spring Breakers with Charlie. And then she did TikTok, which is one of those songs that, like, you don't realize that you know every word to that song until Kesha is singing it in front of you.
Because for 6 years, you were waterboarded by that song whenever you would go into a Bloomingdale's or Nordstrom.
Yeah, exactly. But that was really fun. And Tate McRae also came out and did a little song with Troy. But the other thing that was fun about the show is that it was very fashion focused, like, because Troy and Charlie alternated, you know, doing a couple of songs at a time. There were costume changes every time one of them went off stage. But
oh, is that how it goes? So it's not like Troy performs, then Charlie performs.
No. No.
That's really smart.
Yeah, it was cool. And then sometimes they perform together. I'm honestly scared for their stylists, because the five outfits are different for every single show. It's not like the Renaissance tour where it's like, oh, they have their like 10 looks or whatever that become iconic because they're wearing them every night. She has like a different like asymmetric acne dress for like every one of these shows.
That's a lot of downward pressure on these stylists.
Yeah, I honestly wonder how they're coping. Like, how many different kinds of like motocross themed chaps can one person source?
It's such an interesting tour to me as someone that did not go to it and has only seen it through clips on TikTok and YouTube. But every night seems to be incredible, but it's very clear that early on in the tour, they did the best show, which seems to be the Madison Square Garden reuniting of Charlie and Lorde. Like, I don't know if they can top that experience.
No, I don't think it's possible. Although, if they can get Ariana to come to one of the shows, that would be amazing, because she also has that song with Troy, so they could do two songs.
We're still a month out from Wicked. Ariana Grande is finally in full Wicked press mode.
I can't imagine how she could be more in Wicked press mode than she's been for the past year.
I know. We have some Sex and the City things to talk about.
We do. And first, I want to play this call from the hotline.
Hey, Lauren and Chelsea. I'm just calling because I just finished your episode of recapping The Great Expectations. And I just want to point out, I bet a lot of other fuckettes call and point this out, is that Chelsea is correct. Carrie absolutely does love fluffy shoes. And there's actually evidence of that in the first season when Carrie is shopping at Dolce & Gabbana and she's trying to buy a pair of fluffy shoes. But the cashier cuts her credit card in half but then she is saved by the one Amelita, who ends up buying them for her. So yes, Carrie loves fluffy shoes, and there's visual proof of it. All right, love you guys. Bye.
Thank you to all the fuckettes that called in about this.
And caller, you are correct. We did get many calls, many DMs, many comments about this. A huge oversight on our part.
Of course. How could we have forgotten about the Dolce & Gabbana Marabou sandals?
Because I created a reel that we put on the Instagram that animated and visualized our theme song. And that is what I used, is the scene of Carrie from season one in that episode where she's almost like Dorothy clicking her Marabou heels together.
Unfortunately, neither one of us was in the writer's room in 2003 to make this point, but it's fine.
Could you imagine if 15-year-old and 19-year-old us were in the writer's room?
It's like, we've never had sex, but... Okay, well, I guess I did buy her the time I was 19, but...
You're like this virgin over here. Also, while going through the hotline, I did uncover this call, which we're not going to play because it was quite long, but it did give us some truly great gossip, which is allegedly some real estate goss, is that the owners of Perry Street, which has stood in for Carrie's apartment since the Sex and the City days, got so fed up with the shooting and all the hoopla around their street that they refused to allow And Just Like That to shoot and use Perry Street as the exterior of Carrie's apartment anymore. And the storyline where Carrie buys a Gramercy townhouse to live with Aiden was prompted because of this decision by these owners.
Yeah, would she have even gotten back together with Aiden if not for this drama?
It's interesting understanding that and then looking back in season two, because one of the frustrating things about season two, other than all of it, but more specifically...
Lauren, what did I tell you? Be slightly less of a bitch.
One of the confusing things about season two, which had some high points and some low points, was the fact that they retread the storyline from season one where Carrie's like, I can't be in my Upper East Side apartment anymore. I must move out. And then she moves back in. And in season two, again, she was like, I can't be in this apartment anymore. I gotta move out.
My thought is, though, why could they not just film at the brownstone next door? Is that also owned by the same people? Because the people that own the actual Carrie apartment, in addition to hating the production, they hate the fans that come to take pictures there. So there's always a chain up so people can't go on the steps. Whereas the people that live next door have an identical brownstone and do not have a chain up. Like, we wouldn't be able to tell if they changed the building number.
Many years ago, you and I were lucky enough to stay on the very same block that they shoot Carrie's apartment because a friend of ours happens to have an apartment on that street.
Yeah, shout out to Amy.
So we got to stay there and we did see, and this is pre And Just Like That, just the volume of people that come to this block every day to take photos. And the funniest thing to witness is what Chelsea's describing, is there is a chain up in front of the actual brownstone that they use. And I think there might even be a chain on either side of that brownstone. But to watch people just go to like three brownstones down and take photos as if it's like close enough.
It is close enough. I'm just saying they could find another brownstone that could do the job.
Honestly, why don't they go to the Gilded Age back lot?
Yeah, why don't they just make their own brownstone? Like, they already made the fake exterior of the building during that like sort of time lapse sequence where Carrie was writing her book throughout all the different seasons. Like, let's just build the whole apartment building.
Because the interior shots are shot on a soundstage. Perhaps the Lizette storyline pushed these owners over the edge, where they were like, okay, it's one thing if Carrie lives here, but now we've got this random jewelry designer too that we have to support.
Anyway, thank you to the fuckette that called in and informed us of this. In some Sex and the City 2 related news, JoJo Siwa did a tribute to Liza Minnelli at the Industry Dance Awards. She recreated Liza's performance of Single Ladies from Stanford and Anthony's Wedding.
The legendary Liza Minnelli.
Dare I say, she killed it?
Okay, so JoJo Siwa doesn't know what glam rock and or who Gene Simmons is. But she does know who Liza Minnelli is.
She has seen Sex and the City 2, which was shocking to me.
should we have Jojo Siwa on one of our rewatch episodes?
Oh, I would love that. But this to me really speaks to the fact that for Gen Z, she is the queen of camp. Between Karma, the Gene Simmons of it all, and this, on some level, she gets it.
But like all good camp, I'm not sure if she's aware what she's doing, but she's doing it very authentically and earnestly, which is also what makes it high camp.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of Liza, she is on the cover of Interview magazine this month, shot by Greg Gorman. I love this so, so much.
It was pretty fab.
And of course, she has such a long history with the magazine and with Warhol, and she's basically dressed as herself. The turtlenecks, the Elsa Peretti, all of that.
You can't style Liza to be anyone but Liza.
We never discussed this, but it was recently announced that she has a memoir coming out. It's called Kids Wait Till You Hear This. She's writing it with a couple of other writers, which I think is a good thing. We don't need that like Barbara Streisand, like endless memoir.
Streisand. Yeah, I think that ensures that this is going to come out in less than 10 years. I think it's going to come out in the spring of 2026. When they say Liza Minnelli is writing this with a couple other people, I think she's going to speak and they're going to record the conversation and then make a book out of that, which no shame. I think this is going to be a fascinating read.
Yeah. I don't need Liza Minnelli to be a good writer. I just want to hear all of her stories.
And I do need her to do the audiobook, though.
Or if Liza is not up for that, we could get Kristen Wiig to record the audiobook as Liza Minnelli, as she did on SNL.
What a meta performance. I think the most major image in this Interview magazine editorial for me, and maybe you already knew this, but in her apartment, she has all of these Warhols, and it's two of Warhol's portraits of Liza in the 70s, but they're bookended by a Warhol portrait of her mother and her father.
See, that's some prestige Nepo baby shit right there.
Absolutely.
No, it's so good. She's had those Warhols for years. Like, I have a Architectural Digest from, I think, the 80s when her house was shot, and they were in that too. It was a different house, but very, very cool.
I like that they move with her wherever she goes.
Well, I like that she's consistent with the decor of her houses, with her look. It's part of the reason why she's such a superstar.
I know. So few people have signature styles anymore.
Yeah, no one has any fucking taste, but Liza Minnelli is clearly an exception.
Shall we move on to some fashion news?
Sure.
After a five-year hiatus and many controversies that led to a brand overhaul, Victoria's Secret is back with their fashion show, and it's woke now? ?
Yeah, I don't think that's the correct usage of the term woke.
It's certainly, I would say, a fentified Victoria's Secret fashion show.
Slightly fentified, although thankfully we were spared from modern dance.
And a Johnny Depp appearance.
True.
It seems that the online reaction to this was whelmed. I feel like a lot of the discourse was like, it's not what it used to be. And I'm like, it used to be on network television. I think that this fashion show reflects the budgets of non-traditional media in 2024.
Yeah, like this set was definitely not as elaborate as they've been in the past.
Or perhaps they spent all their money getting Cher to perform.
Although I love how Cher was like, I will do this job, but I will lip sync. I will not even record a custom track so it's like someone could feasibly think that I'm singing live. I'm literally going to sing along to the radio version of Believe and Strong Enough. I will not dance. People can dance around me, but I will walk the length of the runway and then stand on a little platform at some point.
Cher is off screen almost, and then Bella Hadid is walking. And so I was like, wait, is that Bella Hadid? Also, is that Cher on a platform somewhere? Where did she go?
Yeah, I think the Victoria's Secret fashion show has always been bad and kind of great simultaneously.
It's funny because I think in its absence, a generation of girls and boys who watched it when they were very young in its old iteration, like, that's what they associate and that's what they want back. Like, the amount of people who are like, where's the bouncy hair?
I actually didn't mind the hair. I like that they went with, like, huge hair for a lot of the girls.
Yeah, I feel like my biggest issue is they've strayed too far away from the original angel wing concept.
I'm with you.
Yeah, give me more feathery wings and less live, laugh, love script of Victoria's Secret as wings.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the mouse ears at Disneyland, because now they don't just look like mouse ears. They look like fucking mouse ears, but they're cupcakes. They're mouse ears, but they're Maleficent. Just wear fucking mouse ears. And that's exactly how I feel about the wings. We need to stop getting so abstract.
In their need to overhaul the brand, they did away with a lot of the fun of Victoria's Secret that people did enjoy.
But I do like the fact that there was actual, like, lingerie that you could buy in the show. Because that was kind of non-existent the last time they did this. Which is to say, it doesn't make for the most compelling, like, fashions, you know? Like, the look that Gigi came out in, she opened the show, was in some sort of, like, floaty pink romper that was not exciting from a fashion standpoint, but it is cool that you could actually just go and buy it.
Yeah, and oftentimes the Victoria's Secret fashion show is sort of a modeling endurance test. Like, it does feel like something you would have seen in America's Next Top Model, because even Gigi Hadid, you could see, was struggling between the shoes and the weight of the wings to be able to do a very model-esque walk.
For sure. Yeah, it was awkward. And her wings were almost more like a backpack.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't feel effortless or otherworldly. It felt like, oh, this poor girl, how is she going to make it to the front of the runway and back?
Yeah, and one of the models walked out of her own shoes. She got it back on at a certain point, but
they did cut that from the broadcast version. It's weird because this is being billed as a more diverse show for them, but, like, there was, what, 2 plus size models, really?
Ashley Graham and Paloma.
The only two that, like, work. And then, like, 1 mid-size model. And, like, they had some trans models and stuff. And they certainly had more age diversity.
Kate Moss made her debut as a Victoria's Secret angel at 50. I saw Carla Bruni as well.
Okay, but, like, don't make Kate Moss walk to some horrible cover of I Love Rock and Roll.
That was upsetting.
It was really upsetting. I, like, felt bad for Kate Moss that she, like, had to do this. I guess she didn't have to, but I can't imagine it's something that she wanted to do.
Well, I wonder if it's something her daughter wanted to do, because they seem to be a package duo these days. She also was on the runway.
Yeah. We also got Ava Herzegova.
I was wondering if that was her.
Yeah.
Okay.
She looked amazing. Carla Bruni.
I mean, you also had classic Victoria's Secret angels like Alessandra Ambrosia, Adriana Lima, Tyra Banks closed the show.
Tyra Banks did her closing walk. Tat was like, this is very RuPaul. And it's true, because Zaldi, who does all of RuPaul's costumes, was the main costume designer for this event. Like, the hair was so big, and it was just sort of this over-the-top, like, femininity on steroids kind of thing. But that was the best moment of the show, I think, in terms of the walk and the way the crowd responded to her.
I think the reaction to this is so funny, because I think that people don't like the added realism, which I'll put that in quotes, to the show. Like, by the end of the Victoria's Secret fashion shows that were broadcast, right, it was all about the $1 million Swarovski crystal bra. And this genuinely was, like, you can go on the Victoria's Secret website. The things that the models wore, you can actually buy.
Okay, but to an extent, right? Because I saw this one model came out in the classic pink and white striped pajama pants, but it was like an exaggerated version with, like, a very, very wide leg and a higher waist. And I was like, fuck, that's incredible. I will buy that. I go to the website, click on the runway image, and what comes up is just, like, the normal pajama pants. I'm like, that is not the same thing. That is not what I saw on the runway. So I think there's a degree of alterations that happen with certain things, and it's not exact.
To go over the controversies that Victoria's Secret had in the past few years that led us to this point, You had the chief marketing officer, Ed Razek, in 2019 tell Vogue that he did not think transsexuals, I'll put that in quotes, should be included in the Victoria's Secret fashion show. Les Wexner, who was the CEO of L Brand, stepped down in 2021 because of his close friendship with Jeff Epstein. And then in 2020, there was a New York Times investigative piece that reported on the alleged culture of misogyny, bullying, and harassment at the company, and it included interviews with multiple current and former employees and models.
See, this is why watching all of these girls walk to feminine phenomenon made me feel vaguely insane.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like their pivot just made a less worse version of Victoria's Secret.
They still have some work to do, clearly.
It did its job, right? Both you and I went to the Victoria's Secret website after watching this.
Yeah.
Did we buy anything? No, but we might.
I think my struggle with the Victoria's Secret show has always been that their particular beauty ideal, the Adriana Limas, the Candace, wait, what the fuck is her name?
Swoopnil?
That girl? I just don't care about that look. I've never cared about Glamazons. I never even cared about Giselle. Outside of her early, like, modeling in the Alexander McQueen shows kind of vibes.
I mean, they have a very particular type of model. What I thought you were going to say is what my issue with Victoria's Secret is, which I don't like the smell of the stores. Like, their brand of perfume, I just, like, I need a musk going on. And I think that would lure me into the stores and actually buy some stuff.
You don't want to drench yourself in sweet pear body mist? What the fuck is wrong with you?
As we're saying, guys, I think Victoria's Secret has some ways to go before it captures us as consumers.
In some more highbrow fashion news, the Costume Institute announced the theme of their next exhibition. It is called Superfine Tailoring Black Style. It is inspired by Monica L. Miller's 2009 book, Slaves to Fashion, Black Dandyism, and the Styling of the Black Diasporic Identity. She is also the guest curator for this exhibition.
Indeed. And the overall reaction was, oh no. And I think the oh no is a fear that they're going to fuck this up. But I feel like the reaction gets to the heart of the problem with the Met Gala, which is the Met Gala that we associate the first Monday in May, very different than the exhibition itself. This exhibition sounds incredible.
And I think that a lot of people that were commenting negatively about this on Instagram, like, didn't actually read any of the articles about it. Because I think the concern is, like, are there Black people involved in this exhibit? And the answer is yes.
Well, I also think there's a fear of, like, because increasingly, which we've talked about over the last few years that we've had this podcast, increasingly there is this expectation that people will interpret and dress on theme for the Met Gala, which, when it comes to this particular theme or exhibition, concerns people.
Right, and that's not without merit. If we're looking back to the China Through the Looking Glass show, you know, a lot of people came in kimonos, essentially. There is always going to be someone who is going to do something offensive if we're talking about the fashions of another culture. But we also have to remember that with the Met Gala, there's the theme of the exhibit, and then there's also the sub-theme, right?
Which is for the red carpet itself.
Also, at the end of the day, this is a menswear show. People can just wear menswear. And this is also the first menswear exhibit that they've done in like 20 years.
I also think, and I will say this until I'm blue in the face, maybe this is the year that finally breaks people from dressing on theme and we can get back to the way that people used to dress for the Met Gala, which was just dressing well.
We always have this argument every single time we talk about the Met Gala because I'm so anti that. I'm so anti that. Dress on the theme or don't dress on the theme, like, as a form of rebellion. I don't think we need to normalize not dressing on the theme. I think this year, I think if it's about dandies, right, it's about attention to detail. And it's about menswear. Just do that. There's many interpretations of that. Dandyism knows no race.
I look forward to see how this will be interpreted by Sydney Sweeney and Mew Mewer.
Okay, well, I don't think that they're pulling up to the carpet with, like, a strong blaxploitation aesthetic.
Correct. I have faith that this is not going to be as cringy as we want it to be. And I do think it speaks to this reactionary, bad faith sensibility that online discourse has developed. I understand the irony of me saying that is we have a podcast where we comment on pop culture and fashion, but I think there's like almost this glee that people want people to dress fucked up on the red carpet so they can be mad at it.
Absolutely. And look, it's like I understand, obviously, Vogue and the Costume Institute, they don't have the best track record with race historically, and they've been trying to rectify that. Vogue has been hiring more people of color. They've been putting more people of color on the cover of the magazine. The Costume Institute, they've never done a show like this before. They've never done a show about race, but they did highlight a lot of Black designers in both of those recent American-themed exhibits that they did. And that did feel like an attempt to present a more inclusive representation of what American fashion is.
For sure. And in Vanessa Friedman's piece about this particular Met show, she talked to Andrew Bolton, and he did discuss his own journey from 2020 on to rectify a lot of these decisions, you know, actively purchasing more archival pieces from people of color. And he said about this particular exhibition, "I wanted to stage a show on race that could use our collection to tell a story that has been absent from the conversation, both within the museum and outside. This is the first of its kind."
Yes. Also, we should note that the guest curator who wrote the book that this exhibit is based on is a Black woman. And they've hired a lot of cool Black artists to work on the show, like Tyler Mitchell is doing the catalog, Tanda Francis is doing the mannequin heads. So I do think that this exhibit will be quite cool.
For those that want more information about this, we'll put it in the show notes, but there's a great video on the Met website where Andrew Bolton talks about the origin of this exhibition, and he discusses that in Monica L. Miller's book, she invites us to examine men's fashion, not just in terms of race, but also in terms of class, gender, and sexuality.
Will there be an Andre Leontali hologram?
Now that's the more interesting conversation, because there is no more prominent Black dandy in fashion than Andre Leontali, who had a falling out with Anna Wintour. So I do wonder if he will be featured in this exhibition.
I don't think there's a world where he won't. That's what they were talking about when they referenced sexuality.
So the exhibition will tell the Black dandy story over time through a range of media such as garments and accessories, drawings and prints and paintings, photographs, film excerpts, and more.
We should also note that the theme of this exhibit, it's not really new news. This was leaked last year in that Cut article that came out about the fact that the Galliano show had been canned, but obviously that was the bigger news story.
And Andrew Bolton in this Vanessa Friedman piece said that he had been working on the idea of this show since 2021.
That checks out. That timeline, can't say that timeline doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it would seem that Andrew Bolton discovered racism in 2020 and he has responded accordingly.
As we all did. Anywho, in other Vogue-related news, we wanted to talk about the November. It is the November cover, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's got to be November because it's like election month.
Correct. But wait, is it a dual cover? I'm confused.
I don't know, because the Billie Eilish cover came out first.
Yes, and it does say November, but then a few days ago they were like, boom, Kamala Harris.
Why not have two covers? Who cares? They both got two like full press cycles. The Billie Eilish cover, I was like, wow.
I love her styling in the editorial.
Yeah, good for them. Like two in a row with the Lady Gaga and the Billie Eilish. I'm like, oh, wow, it does seem like it's a magazine that reflects the times that we are living in some capacity. Although the Kamala Harris cover,
I mean, she got Annie Leibovitzified.
Yeah, which means that the position of the body does not match the position of the face. And I feel like her hands are even like shot separately or something.
Well, yes, because it's cobbled together from several different takes.
And if you look at the Billie Eilish and the Kamala cover side by side, it's like you realize what a natural looking cover looks like versus one that is made in post, essentially.
Here's the problem, though, because every other photo, especially the photos of Kamala that are from a distance. Like, there's one where she's getting on a plane. There's one where she seems to be in the bowels of a stadium before a campaign event. Those are incredible.
Yeah.
But anything that's like a medium shot looks Frankensteined in Photoshop.
And it sucks because this is her second Vogue cover, and neither one of them have been good, but for different reasons.
Right. What was wrong with the first cover?
The first cover was widely criticized because it did look like an outtake.
Right.
People basically just like thought it wasn't a good photo and that it was too casual. Like, she was in sneakers. Like, it was a little unbecoming for like a vice president.
It gave the energy of, oops, we killed the original cover. Who else can we put on? Here's hoping for a third cover.
So I have been watching The Real Housewives.
Guys, I could not be more thrilled to be discussing The Real Housewives with Chelsea. We are discussing New York. Chelsea, it's like Bravo knew how to get your ass, because now there's not just one lesbian. This season, there's two lesbians on this show. And guess what? They're both late in life lesbians.
Wait, what is the new lesbian's name?
Raquel Chevremont.
And Raquel is the art consultant for And Just Like That?
That is right. Raquel was a model. She's an art curator and collector. And yes, she was the art advisor in And Just Like That.
Which means that she basically just did LTW's apartment in that one scene, in that one room that we've never seen again. The Derek Adams was only on loan for that one week.
For a short amount of time. That's why the entirety of LTW's storyline takes place in her closet.
I love Jenna. I love this new lesbian. However, this show still makes me feel like garbage. I don't understand why people watch this. They have the most redundant arguments about the pettiest shit all the time.
Look, you should know, this season, not good. Last season, also not good. The drama is very tepid. Okay, did Aaron insinuate that Brynn was a sugar baby on Jeff Lewis's radio show?
No! Brynn is telling on herself with that.
The lady doth protest a little too much.
Like, I didn't think you were a sugar baby before, and now I do. Because of your reaction.
I know. Previously, Jenna in the first season wasn't really brought into this, but now she is in these first couple episodes. It's like, did Jenna tell Cy that Brynn hates her? Is Jenna Lyons broke because she didn't pay Aaron back for an Uber?
Okay, I will say the only other housewives I like aside from the lesbians kind of fuck with Jessel.
Interesting.
Jessel is not a bad vibe. At least Jessel seems like a reasonably happy person. At least she can crack a joke. At least her vibes aren't completely toxic.
You do need the unaware, self-aware cast member. Like, I feel like Dorinda was that for the previous iteration of Roni. And there's something about Jessel where she's the court jester of this iteration of Roni, where it's like she's freely admitting, like, I've never taken the subway. How much have I spent on Uber this month? Oh, $900.
Which, actually, in New York, I don't think is that bad, considering how expensive Uber is. That basically means that she, like, took one cab from Tribeca to the Upper East Side and back.
She is a punching bag for the other women. However, I think unlike any of the other women who are married to men, I think she actually has a happy marriage. I love her husband's journey as a food influencer.
Yeah, when I watch these shows, I can't help but think, like, the men and the women hate each other. Is that just what heterosexual marriage is?
After a while, I hear, yeah.
Yeah, you've made it for how many months now?
Three.
Wow.
I think there's something about reality television that attracts people whose marriages are truly about to end. I think the best example of this was Camille Grammer on the first season of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, because Kelsey Grammer was actively having an affair with someone else and clearly wanted to get out of the marriage and encouraged her to join The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. I think so she had something to do or fall back on. But, like, the best housewives are when actual real shit is going on. When Erica Jane's husband got arrested. Like, when the housewives make headlines and then that's shown on the show, it's great. But we have none of that. I also want to get your opinion on the fact that we still do not have Jenna Lyons' girlfriend, Cass Bird, on the show. But we did get Cass Bird's mother.
That to me makes sense because I understand why Cass doesn't want to come on the show. It doesn't seem like something that would benefit her. But at the same time, I think the note to Jenna was probably like, we need to see more of your family life if we're not going to see Cass.
Right.
We got to see your future mother-in-law. We got to see, you know, your son, all of that.
The most interesting thing is Raquel's very hot girlfriend, Mel.
Yeah, they are such a cool couple. I'm obsessed with them. They love riding their motorcycles.
Absolutely. They also have, and am I allowed to say this, Chelsea? The most lesbian backstory.
Yeah, they do.
Because they've been friends for over 12 years, and they were single when they got together, but it does seem like the timeline is a little squishy for Mel and her ex-wife of when she got with Raquel.
That's also part of lesbian culture. Many lesbian couples that I know are quite cagey about when they first started dating and sort of give conflicting answers around that.
Speaking of housewives who are cagey, the fashion designer Rebecca Minkoff is now on the show.
Oh my God. And she's a Scientologist?
And she does not want to talk about it. Rebecca Minkoff seems to be another genre of housewife. Kelly Bensimone was like this as well, where it's the, I didn't know what this show was like before getting on it. She seems completely unprepared to acknowledge that she's a Scientologist.
Yeah, like think of a snappy, like two sentence response that like includes a joke.
I know they have publicists in Scientology. Although it seems all they are taught to do is attack, attack, attack. So this should be interesting.
Also, another takeaway from watching this show is that I never want to wear a designer logo of any kind ever again. Like, I'm going to have to go and like Sharpie the sides of my sunglasses after watching this show.
Yeah, that's a fair takeaway.
It just looks so gauche, and I'm like, oh my God.
Speaking of gauche, Jenna Lyons getting a $200,000 Bentley.
Okay, I love that though.
But doesn't seem her style.
I mean, I'm not one to speak on cars. I don't understand the appeal of most luxury cars at all.
I feel like Carrie to Samantha about the Birkin. That's not even your style. But maybe that's the thing. It's about what it represents.
I don't know. To me, Jenna Lyons, like, really does function as a tastemaker. Like, if she likes this car, I'm like, okay, I like that car.
Never thought twice about Bentleys. When that Bentley rolled up in slow-mo, I was like, it's got a look to it. Yeah. I could be into this.
Yeah, good for her.
I'm very excited that you're watching Roni. I will have to ask of you, it's coming back soon. I don't know exactly when, but Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, Jennifer Tilly is being introduced as a friend of.
Wait, she's not a full housewife?
No, but honestly, that's the position you want to be in. You don't want to be a full-time housewife. Like, you have to sacrifice too much of your dignity. Like, I would love to be a friend of. You come in for a couple episodes, stir some shit, and leave.
Yeah, like Candace Bushnell.
Yes.
Moving on to some other crazy 1% shit.
That's right. We watched the Menendez Brothers documentary that was on Netflix.
Our boys got to tell their side of the story from prison in a bunch of phone interviews.
I don't know about you. Maybe it speaks to how much of a true crime head I am, but I knew most of this information that was in this documentary.
There wasn't a lot of new information.
No, I'll tell you the two things I did get from this documentary, Chell. These boys love their father. Like, even 30 years on, they seem very concerned about his legacy and it being preserved.
Yeah.
Which is a little difficult for me to get my head around. Because many times in this documentary, they both Lyle and Eric are like, you need to understand how great of a man our father was.
Yeah, it's like from everything I'm hearing, he's not sounding that major.
And the other thing I got from this documentary is what a piece of work the female prosecutor was.
Oh, my God.
But even she's like, I could not find anyone that had anything nice to say about Jose Menendez except his secretary.
Yeah.
Like, this literally was a man that the prosecution, who was trying to bring their killers to justice, they could not find one witness who basically didn't say this guy got what he deserved.
Yeah, clearly he did, and clearly so did she. Sorry, not sorry. Because, look, I know a lot of people to this day do not believe that the Menendez brothers were abused, that they're lying about the whole thing. But I just don't understand then, what's the incentive for the cousin to lie about the abuse, or the guy from Menudo to come forward and say that Jose Menendez drugged and raped him? Like, how does that factor into this?
Right. So the two things that weren't covered in the documentary are the two pieces of information that has made the Los Angeles DA, Greg Gascon, look at this case again. As Chelsea said, one of the pieces of evidence is this uncovered letter that Andy Cano, cousin of Eric and Lyle Menendez, found recently, and it's a letter from 1988 that Eric wrote to him discussing the abuse by Jose Menendez. And then the other piece of information, as you talked about, was Roy Rosello, who is a former member of Menudo, came forward in a 2023 Peacock documentary that he was drugged and raped by Jose Menendez when he was a teen, and Jose Menendez was the head of RCA Records. If they are indeed lying, then if you watch the footage of them on the stand, they are better than Daniel Day-Lewis as actors?
I'm sorry, but it is not possible that they're both that good at acting. It's just not.
And also, in the 30 years since the case, their story hasn't deviated at all, which is another thing that points to them that they were telling the truth. And I agree with you. I think they acted in what's called, and it's talked about in the documentary, imperfect self-defense, and it should have been ruled as a manslaughter or third-degree murder. And clearly, by that ruling, they would have already been out of prison. But the jurors of the first case, as is discussed in this documentary, just couldn't imagine that boys could have been sexually abused.
And by the jurors, you mean the men?
Yes, the men, sorry. Particularly the men.
I understand that when boys are sexually abused, it's very taboo, but it's not as if it's uncommon.
As Lyle says, 16 years later, Oprah did her landmark episode about men who had been abused.
That was upsetting. I remember watching that live after middle school.
From when they were arrested to the first trial to the second trial, O.J. Simpson gets arrested, his trial happens, and he wins the case. That was so brutal for the DA's office. They had such egg on their face that they really had no choice but to push through a win with a high-profile case, and that happened to be the Menendez brothers, because the abuse was kept out of the second trial. So as a jury member in this documentary says, who was a juror on the second trial, was like, our choice was murder or nothing.
Yeah, so you're not getting the testimony from the boys. You're not getting the testimony from the cousin saying, like, not only did he tell me about this, but I told their mom about it.
I will say, I believe they were abused. I do believe that they should be released. Obviously, what those two new pieces of evidence that have come to light that Chell and I were just talking about, the DA is currently looking at. And on Wednesday, he held a press conference and he said that it seems within the next 10 days, he will make a ruling of if they are going to resentence the brothers. That is their most likely way to get released.
They could also get pardoned by Joe Biden, potentially.
There's that.
You never know.
I just find it fascinating that the brothers don't comment on in this documentary or in others that I've seen, nor do their supporters really discuss, is the fact that they spent nearly $700,000 in the 10 months after their parents passed away. I just find it curious.
Right. And that's a detail that I think a lot of people haven't been able to get past with the case. When they've talked about it, they've been like, well, yes, we did that, but also we were suicidal at the time. Like, we went crazy after the murders.
I think what happened to them absolutely happened. I also think they were like, we've lived in hell for so long, we're going to enjoy some of the spoils.
Oh, absolutely. Two things can be true. They can be victims of abuse and also just kind of like annoying Beverly Hills entitled rich kids, whatever.
And I think the lack of admitting that or holding space for the two, it's irked me just a little bit.
What's wild also in this is seeing like Kathy Griffin talking about it.
Oh, boy. Oh, and your love, Sandra Bernhard, has an awful take. They show a clip of her on Letterman being like, I think those boys should fry.
Okay, no comment. Love, Sandra.
We forget. We were alive and watching media when this trial was happening, but it just went to a joke so quickly, to the point that there is a parody of this trial in The Cable Guy.
That's like the best media within media ever.
And, you know, they got Kim Kardashian on their side.
Goddess bless. she posted on Instagram a photo of them with a lengthy caption. She also wrote an op-ed for the LA Times about the case, about how key evidence was suppressed and how their sentencing is unfair.
The documentary does end on kind of a crazy note where they have the prosecutor from the first trial yelling at the TikTok supporters, and she reminds them that she has a gun if they decide to be crazy and come to her house, which is like, okay, so your whole case was that these boys killed their parents with shotguns, and you're like, by the way, I also have a gun and I will murder you ruthlessly if you come to my house.
Yep.
Ironic much?
She was great, though, in the sense that she was so eccentric. Like, every documentary needs that.
They need an unhinged white woman.
And she delivered.
I think that does it. I think we've talked about all the things.
That we have. We will be back next week with a hotline episode.
It's a juicy one, guys. And we will be off in London doing two live shows. I would promote them, but they've sold out, so...
And sorry, we're also out of comps. Just putting it out there. Thank you guys for listening as always.
Absolutely. We'll be back next week with that hotline episode.
Bye.
Bye.